Good morning and happy Monday, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Defiant Podcast. Thank you for joining me. I'm your host, Majid Padellan, a.k.a. Brooklyn Dad Defiant. Let's talk about protest. The very fabric of our nation's DNA is heavily steeped in the history of protest. I mean, the act of people crossing the Atlantic, leaving England, to form our own nation was the biggest protest of all. The Boston Tea Party, throwing a bunch of boxes of tea in the water, protesting taxation without representation. The Revolutionary War, major protest. Rosa Parks refused to sit in the back of the bus. Now that is defiant. In the Civil Rights Movement, people peacefully sat in whites-only diners to protest Jim Crow segregation laws. Millions of American citizens utilized marches, sit-ins, and burned draft cards in protest of the Vietnam War. A professional football player, Colin Kaepernick, silently took a knee during the singing of the national anthem to protest police violence against unarmed black civilians. In most of these cases, with the exception, of course, you know, of war, these protests were nonviolent. In all of these cases, people were putting themselves out there publicly in front of crowds to state their opposition to injustice, to how certain people were being treated or killed. In all of these cases, these protests were not convenient for people not engaged in the protest. People just trying to get to and from work while a protest is blocking the road. Very inconvenient, frustrating, and even annoying. People affected by these protests, "Hey, I'm not the one oppressing you. Why are you penalizing me?" is probably the most common reaction. And I guess you can't blame them because they don't understand the nature of protest. Protest is not meant to be convenient. Protest is not meant to be comfortable. Protest, when it's most effective, is meant to make as many people as possible uncomfortable. Otherwise, who actually gives a shit? If civil rights protests were quietly, politely conducted in the privacy of one's own basement, without even raising your voice, just sitting in prayer silently, well, we wouldn't have overcome, would we? If nobody made a fuss about the people dying in the Vietnam War, how much longer would America have remained? Uncomfortable. Very uncomfortable and inconvenient. And it's protected by the First Amendment. That's how important the right to protest is in America. We made it first. More than guns. But that doesn't mean we get to abuse it, does it? That thing about yelling fire in a crowded theater that's not on fire? That's illegal. You can't use your First Amendment right to infringe upon our right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Your protest can make us uncomfortable. Loud noises, obstructing traffic, sit-ins, work stoppages, boycotts, all of those things are fair game. But when you threaten someone's safety, you have crossed the line. When you use your First Amendment rights to say somebody else does not have the right to exist, like, what the fuck is that, actually? You have lost the plot. If your protest in defense of people who are being wrongfully bombed in massive numbers, if your protest means targeting people who had nothing to do with the political or military decision-making process that leads to that bombing, then you are wrong. Full stop. I'm Muslim. My dad was Jewish. My sister is Jewish. My best friend who passed away was Jewish. I hate what happened on October 7th. I denounce Hamas in the strongest possible terms. I denounce Netanyahu in the strongest possible terms. He only seems interested in prolonging the war to save his job with no regard for civilians. I abhor the killing of over 30,000 Palestinians, including over 10,000 children. I mean, who with a heart wouldn't despise that? I believe that Israel has the right to defend itself. I also question whether the sustained indiscriminate bombing for months on end of civilians in pursuit of Hamas, I question if that counts as self-defense if you're using a sledgehammer instead of a scalpel. I don't think it's humane to prevent supplies from getting through, systematically starving thousands of people to death. How does that count as self-defense? It looks like collective punishment. It makes me angry that the weapons we supply Israel with are being used to slaughter civilians who have been herded, starving, into a tiny area of Rafah, which Netanyahu is preparing to mercilessly bludgeon. I know our support for Israel isn't tied to just one president. It's a long-standing U.S. policy. But the current leader of Israel's wanton disregard for civilian lives makes me wonder if we shouldn't be revising our policy until he's been replaced. And I feel like both sides are talking past each other. Yeah, what about my pain and suffering? What about how you killed my people? All of those voices of protest are valid. Their concerns should be heard. But how do we move forward from there without continuing the cycle of pain, retribution, and death? I believe there should be a two-state solution. It's the only way to sustainable peace. And I also believe that there is no overnight path to that sustainable peace. I think it has to begin at the lowest, most local possible level on both sides. Rabbis and imams have to be committed to preach peace to their followers nonstop until the message breaks through. If you don't reach people's hearts and minds, it won't matter how many Republican and Democratic presidents stick their noses into the Middle East. It won't matter how many people intervene. Now for the big conversation. We welcome back to the show our friend Malcolm Nance. You may know Nance as the globally renowned expert on terrorism, extremism, and insurgency from his stunning new book, They Want to Kill Americans, The Militias, Terrorists, and Deranged Ideology of the Trump Insurgency. It became a New York Times bestseller, as was his last book, The Plot to Hack America. He's the counterterrorism analyst for NBC and MSNBC. And Nance is considered one of the quote-unquote great African-Americans in espionage by the International Spy Museum. But he's also extremely well-sourced on the what's happening in the armed forces and has spent time on the front lines of Ukraine. Today, he shifts his expertise and perspective to what's happening across America and who's behind these mass protests in Gaza. We'll talk about the potential blowback for President Biden and the Democratic coalition in general as the student left pulls the party in a potentially dangerous direction. Let's go to the tape. Okay, Malcolm, thank you so much for joining me here on the Defiant Podcast. It's an honor to have you here.
Oh, I'm really glad to be here, because if there's any name that I can certainly relate to, it's defiant.
That's right.
Of that word.
Yeah. In fact, the last time you and I spoke, it was on my other show, was Storytime with BDD. And you were one of the earliest voices expressing extreme confidence in Ukraine's ability to not only hold their ground, but also to push back against Russia and defeat them. See, I myself was skeptical because, you know, growing up, you know, we learned that Russia, well, back then Russia was the Soviet Union, and they were like the big bad power that we were, you know, trained to fear. How on earth has Ukraine fared this well for so long?
Well, for those of your followers that don't know, I was in the Ukrainian army for a better part of a year. You know, when I left MSNBC, I went over and I joined the Ukrainian army.
How old are you, Malcolm?
I was 60 at the time. And
why?
I actually took part in the largest offensive against Russia since World War II on my 61st birthday as a designated marksman sniper of 3rd Battalion International Legion. But before that, you know, I went to Ukraine a month before the war, and I was studying how would Russia do it? How would their invasion routes have to work their way through Ukraine? Here's the first thing I'm going to teach your listeners. Ukraine is not a small country. Ukraine is the distance between New York City and Tampa, Florida.
That's big.
And the war is in the last 30 minutes of an 18-hour end-to-end drive. It takes 18 hours to go from the Polish border to the Russian border. Mm. And if you were to go to the southeast corner and continue driving, the war would only be in the last 30 minutes of your drive. But it's a very large area. It's 1,100 kilometers long. It's, you know, several hundred, you know, a couple hundred kilometers deep, mm-hmm. In the places that Russia took. First in 2014, the province of Donetsk and Luhansk, which they seized almost, you know, with very little combat. Then mm-hmm. in 2022, they tried to seize a whole bunch more of Ukraine. They seized Kherson province in the south in order to make their way to Odessa and got stopped. They seized Zaporizhia province, half of that. They seized Kharkiv province, part of that in the north, Sumy in the northeast, and then Chernihiv north of Kyiv, and then the outer parts of Kyiv province to the north. Mm-hmm. And if there was any one thing, I met the top two battle commanders 10 days before the invasion, General Sirsky, who is now commander of the Ukrainian Armed Forces, and General Pavlyuk, who is now commander of Ukraine's land warfare forces. Mm. And I said this on air and got a lot of pushback from an MSNBC host, where I said, hey, wait a minute. You know, you're talking about defeating Russia, Russia rolling through there in no time. And they had some academic on with me. And I said, first off, you have not been here. Kyiv is the size of Chicago. And there mm-hmm. are little old ladies filling up Molotov cocktail bottles by the way, they stuff styrofoam in it so that it sticks to your body and melts onto you.
Oh, my God.
Right. It's not just gasoline with a little torch in it. It's styrofoam. It's the bottle, styrofoam, detergent, right? Dawn liquid, mm-hmm. and then gasoline, and it becomes napalm. And I am not joking. In the run-up to the war, there were hundreds and hundreds of bottles just sitting next to checkpoints, where little old ladies from the 20th floor were going to chuck them out the window, what they called the Bandera milkshake. Wow. And I said, they're never taking this city. They're never taking the city of Kyiv. It is too big. They don't have enough resources. I've been tracking the Russian army units. I go, they don't have enough men. And, you know, I got some severe pushback, like, well, what do you know? You know, you're just there and you just studied them. But one factor I said was, I was told, well, you know, Russia has this massive army. And I said, yeah, I know Russia has a massive army. That doesn't matter. Okay. We get routinely defeated by men in flip-flops. Mm. But what you need to understand is the Ukrainians have an army. And if you think about it, the run-up to the war, no one ever talked about the Ukrainian army. No one.
No.
They're showing Russian footage of airplanes shooting rockets and tanks running everywhere. The Ukrainian army was not sitting around. They had been in the field with all of their war stocks open for 2 weeks, waiting like this, preparing their positions, getting their ambushes ready. And when the Russians invaded, they slaughtered them with a capital S. Mm. Even though Russia used mass to push in, they kicked their ass. And so usually when people ask me, hey, Malcolm, how's the war in Ukraine going? We kick their ass. I mean, just an ass kicking. It slowed down to a trickle of ass kicking. And yes, Russia is making some advances in the last few months, but I can measure those advances in a dozen or more kilometers.
Would you attribute it to military strategy or equipment or training or, you know, fatigue on the Russian side? What would you attribute, you know, their success to?
Two things. And one, I went to school for one of those things. The other one you couldn't create, all right? First was the U.S.-supplied Javelin missile, which, by the way, the 1,200 or some odd missiles that the United States had given to Ukraine under the Obama administration that the Trump administration held up as extortion for Vladimir Zelensky. Right? And once it got released after the impeachment, the Ukrainians had this weapon system. I went to Javelin shooter school. I was with GERD, Ministry of Defense Intelligence, all of their paramilitary teams, which is where I was with, went to javelin school. And I was like, this is the coolest toy ever. You put a little sight on, it's got thermal optic, it sees way out there, you know, fog doesn't clear, you know, you could have fog, snow, whatever. It sees the heat signature of the tank. And then what you do is you look through the actual seeker head on the missile. So you are seeing what the missile will see when it goes flying, right? And so when you're ready to launch, you're looking at the tank through the missile sensor. And then you press launch on what we call the CLU, the command launch unit, and whoosh, missile goes off, and the missile will go to whatever it just saw. It won't stop until it gets there and hits it or goes over the top, blows up, and shoots down through the other part. And boy, we were slaughtering. The Ukrainians were slaughtering the Russians with these Javelin missiles. And the British NLAW, you know, the new light anti-tank weapon, which I learned to fire also, has a cool little red dot optic that you use. And they were just ambushing Russian tanks in forests and villages. And they didn't use these on trucks, only on tanks, right? And at night, they would go out into the forest and they would destroy. The only priority we had was the destruction of fuel trucks. But all of this, how did they defeat a much larger army? They literally destroyed three full Russian armies, right? The one from the northwest, the one from the northeast, and the one from the east. Just slaughtered them. How? Because the Ukrainians have something the Russians don't have. And that's, they got guts. Mm. I mean, these people, we used to call it the Cossack attitude. Right? They would, I said, Ukrainians, and they're like, Russians are out there. They were like, oh, Russians? And they get that little gleam in their eye. They start twirling their mustache and taking out their sword, running over their head. It is like, whoa, whoa, whoa. It is, they all wanted to fight. And we were like, whoa, boys. Let's do a little intelligence collection first before you run out there and start, you know, wailing away. It was little bighorn for the Russians every day. Okay. Swirling bands of Cossacks, you know, riding circles around them and just wiping them out. And the Russians are a bunch of yahoos. They didn't want to be there, right? None of them had any skill, or some people didn't even know they were in Ukraine until they saw the Ukrainian gas stations full of whiskey and liquor, because gas stations there are awesome, by the way. The whole walls of liquor. And in my pre-war assessment, when I drove the invasion route from the northeast, I was counting the number of Sokar and Oko gas stations, because they're like three times the size of a 7-Eleven. And one entire wall is alcohol, like French wine, and Georgian brand, you know, Armenian brandy. They had Jack Daniels on display next to the front case, plastic wrapped with a six pack of Coke. So you would buy a whole Jack and Coke thing. And I was like, the Russians are never getting past these gas stations. Drink themselves blind at night. Exactly what happened. And then the Cossacks came out at night, which is why so many tractors were pulling pure untouched Russian tanks, because they were just slaughtering the soldiers.
First, they get them drunk, and then they...
Well, the Russians just get drunk anyway. I mean, they're just natural drunks. I'm not, that's not an exaggeration. I could tell you about a facility I saw when we seized the city of Kupiansk. We took over a logistics base and a special forces base. And there was, I have a photograph of it, a pile of bottles that was 21 feet long, 7 meters long, by 2 meters wide. That's 6.5, maybe 8 feet wide by 3 feet high. Of empty hard liquor bottles, not beer, hard liquor. And they were assembling them all in one place because somebody was going to take them empty bottles home to Russia and make some money off of a refill. I couldn't believe it when I went rolling into this place. I'm like, all tactical and shit. I'm like, hell yeah, what? It's so dangerous. You never take a phone out, right? I go, no one will believe me. I was the intelligence guy, so I had a phone. I was like, I got to take a picture of this. No one will believe the approximate 3,000 or 4,000 bottles.
That's crazy.
Of liquor that the Russians were drinking. Just in this compound. They emptied the country of every bottle of whiskey and vodka and whatever. So
Malcolm, let me switch gears with you a little bit. I want to talk briefly about the importance of the aid package for Ukraine. So what in your mind was the game that the GOP was trying to play to, you know, to try to prevent its the passage of that bill?
You know, years ago, back in 2016, when I was still young, I wrote a book that was describing the Russian intelligence operation that was designed to get Donald Trump elected president. And the book was called Plot to Hack America. It became like a real sleeper book, New York Times bestseller. Still to this day, that book is still like $10 or $15 if you can get a copy of it. It still sells and it's out of print. Wow. And in that book, I had a chapter I called The Kremlin Crew with K, right? The Kremlin Crew. And I talked about Paul Manafort, Boris Epstein, all of these guys who, and Trump, and how they were completely enamored with Moscow. Steve Bannon, you know, who's technically Trump's, you know, subversive campaign manager, was a huge follower of a Russian philosopher called Alexander Dugin. And Dugin was the believer or developed a philosophy called Neo-Eurasianism, which is where the poles of the world would flip, upending where America and Western Europe would be one bulwark against Russia. And if done right through subversion and buying conservative political movements in Europe, they could flip the poles of the world to where Moscow would be the central axis of the world with a conservative, dictatorial, fascistic Donald Trump administration holding up the Western wall of what I call the axis of autocracies. Mm. And they were pushing autocracy all throughout Europe. They gave Marine Le Pen almost $50 million, the woman who challenged Macron in France. They essentially bought the government of Austria and they were elected. They tried to do a coup d'etat in Macedonia to get the Russians a naval base in the Adriatic Sea using Serbian terrorists. They funded AfD in Germany, right wing, crazy anti-immigrant, you know, movement in Germany. And Moscow was essentially trying to flip the world on its head through judo with money.
I just wanted to back you up a bit because I swear about 2 or 3 minutes ago, you said buy conservative. And I just wanted to make sure I heard you correctly. So you're saying these guys are actually buying our politicians?
Sure. Absolutely buying our politicians. And I wrote another book about it called The Plot to Destroy Democracy, how Putin and his spies were undermining America and dismantling the West. And in it, I show every conservative group in Europe and how they're getting all this money from United Russia, which is Putin's political action. It's his party. And so in there are three unique chapters. One where the Russians buy the American extremist evangelical movement. Mm-hmm. And they started holding these conferences called the Defense of Christianity Conference in Moscow every year. And it was for crazy extremists, right? Focus on the family, groups like that. But it got so popular in the evangelical movement that, what's his name? Franklin Graham was coming there every year and was like hanging out with Putin and talking about how awesome a Russian Orthodox Christian he was and how Christianity was under attack from Islam, which, by the way, was Osama bin Laden's strategy to create a culture war between Islam and the West. These guys were picking up that mantle. So first they bought the evangelicals, and I mean, they're bought. Next, Steve Bannon, the actual founder of the alt-right. Do you know the alt-right actually started with computer gaming?
I didn't know that, no.
Steve Bannon made all of his hundreds of millions of dollars by hiring Chinese gamers to go on these games and collect the points, you know, and little trinkets and power-up and level-ups and selling them for cash to American gamers. But on the Discord servers, where you could do all your chat and stuff, they were talking up what it is to be, you know, a real American man, right? Conservative, radical, hating all those women. That's where Gamergate came from.
Hang on a second. Just a little while ago, there was a guy who it was an American young guy in his 20s or something, and he was literally just arrested. And he had his own group. I'm hoping that I'm ringing a bell for you on this thing here. He did this through a Discord group. Exactly what you're saying.
Is it the guy we got arrested in Idaho that was going? No, that guy was going to join ISIS. Anyway, the right wing was using these Discord servers, and Steve Bannon literally created the alt-right from these young white men gamers, and it expanded, and he was pushing his philosophy on these computer servers, on these chat rooms, about what it is to be a man. Well, you got to smack bitches, and you got to, you know, do all this stuff. And then when the alt-right got together with the neo-Nazis and the Confederate Heritage people, that was supposed to be their cotillion. That was supposed to be their coming out as a political action arm of the Trump administration. Mm. And here's the kicker. The two leaders of that movement, David Duke was a big one, and Richard Spencer, the head of the American Neo-Nazi Party, both owned apartments in Moscow, as did the head of the American California Separatist Movement, the America Texas Separatist Movement. These people were all being feted by Moscow. So between Bannon, Richard Spencer, I can't remember the name of the head of the alt-right who formed Charlottesville, he too was going to Moscow for all these movements. What we saw the Soviets do in Western Europe with like terrorist groups, IRA, Red Army faction in the 60s and 70s, Moscow was doing with conservatives in the 2000s and turning them into a force. And then the final part of it was buying the NRA with Maria Butina and their, you know, what was it? Right to Bear Arms movement by,
that was,
you know,
a redheaded spy, wasn't it?
Yeah, she was an actual FSB officer. Yeah. She was arrested as what we called an unregistered agent of a foreign power. That's FBI talk for a trained spy from a foreign country. And her job was to infiltrate the Trump administration, which she did. This woman was the first person to ever, first foreigner to ever ask Donald Trump a question about Russia at his inaugural campaign press event in Las Vegas, 2 years after he had already gone to Moscow and was being pushed by the Russians to run for president.
Malcolm, let me ask you this question, because I keep asking different people this question, and I'm not getting satisfactory answers. With all of these blatant security failures between us and Russia, where it seems like at will Russian spies are infiltrating and gaining access, why don't we have a better firewall to prevent the corruption of our politicians from Russian influence?
You know, back in the oldie days, when I was young and, you know, we were going up against the KGB, and my job was, you know, not to be flipped into an asset by the Russians, we were getting constant security briefings about how they did operations, how they would try to recruit you. Things have sort of changed. We don't view the FSB as a malignant force. White evangelical Trump supporters don't view Russia as a malignant force at all, because Donald Trump's personal love of Vladimir Putin, it filters down into the cult. Mm. And whatever Donald Trump says is correct. So all of the Marjorie Taylor Greens and all the rest of them, you want to be a Trump lover, you got to love Moscow. You want to have Trump in your good graces, you got to hate Ukraine, because Ukraine got Zelensky, and Zelensky got Trump impeached.
And right, so, but there's separation though between Donald Trump and our national security. Right, he's no longer the chief executive of the country. Like
you would think, but here's where the FBI is now, and during the Mueller report and all that stuff, how come these things weren't investigated first? Mm-hmm. The Mueller was not allowed to conduct any counterintelligence investigation of Donald Trump or his staff. was mandated out. Also, counterintelligence tends to not go towards an effect that you can see. What they prefer to do is what we call ABC, right? Always be collecting. Mm-hmm. You go in, you monitor whoever is an asset or an unwitting, you know, asset, and you're trying to get the actual agent of a foreign power or his communications, and then read back where this is originating from. So if Marjorie Taylor Greene, and I say this all the time, people are like, oh, the FBI, Trump was saying that, the FBI shouldn't have 702 power authority to monitor American citizens. Mm-hmm. Well, the only authority they have is the authority to get a warrant. And the only way they're going to get a warrant is if you're talking to a spy, right? If you're not talking to Osama bin Laden's son, who's dead, I think, or an SVR, the clandestine service of the FSB, the Russian CIA spies, right? Mm-hmm. If you're talking to one of them on a phone that's in Moscow, we're going to roll on you. Okay, that's spy talk for, you know, when I was at NSA. We're going to press the button, we're going to boop, and it's going to roll tape on you. And I'm going to get up from my terminal, and I'm going to call the watch officer at the National SIGINT or National Security Watch Operations Center at NSA, and I'm going to say, bring the general counsel down, boys. I got a live one. And then I'm going to take my hands off the terminal, and lawyers and super spies are going to come down, and they're going to go, I got an American citizen talking to the director of Russia's clandestine service, and he's offering his services to Moscow. Well, now that's lawyer time. Mm-hmm. And an FBI liaison at NSA will come in there, and he'll go, what do you got? And then he'll be like, I'm going out for coffee, because I'm now because it involves an American citizen, I can't have anything to do with this. Lawyers and FBI officers, and that guy will put the headphones on, right, and start doing whatever, and he will draft up a FISA warrant request pursuant to American citizen communicating with a clandestine officer offering to become an asset of a foreign intelligence agency, which happens all the time. We just caught a Chinese one. And the FISA court, he'll go there, and the FISA court will go, whoa, here's your warrant. Okay, roll on them all day long, because to get caught, you know, to do that Julian Assange stuff and stuff Snowden says, you got to be a spy or you got to be a terrorist. And we're not doing this to Joe Blow, because one, I don't have time. I have to get coffee, right? Yeah. I don't waste my coffee time on idiots.
So it's a very high bar, I guess, that has to be met in order for certain security protocols to click into gear.
Now, Marjorie Taylor Greene can call Vladimir Putin, okay? And there's a protocol for that if it's authorized. If she just wants to, you know, roll up and call him, well, you know, there's procedures for this. She may be notified. She may not be notified. Her side of the conversation may not be preserved. There are lawyers and FBI officers for this, because this falls under the National Security Division of Justice, and it falls under the Counterintelligence Division of the FBI, which I want to call attention to something. When Trump found out that, you know, Jared Kushner had called the Russians and asked for a private secure communications channel, which to me is pressing buttons and I'm calling lawyers, right? I'm like, get your ass down here. We got a hot one, right? It's like you're essentially asking to be a spy. They talk their way out of it. But to ask a foreign power for a secure cryptographic system to where you could not be intercepted by an American intelligence agency, which is the FBI, the only ones are allowed to do this with a FISA warrant. The first person Donald Trump went after was Peter Strzok, the director of the FBI's counterintelligence division, the top spy hunter in America. Coincidence takes a lot of planning, as I like to say.
Indeed. Now,
that's crazy talk. That's a sign of guilt.
I want to back up to, you just mentioned a few minutes ago, Marjorie Taylor Greene. I want to touch on Mike Johnson, or as I like to call him, MAGA Mike Johnson, who he was at the center of that whole Ukraine funding fiasco where, you know, it seemed like he finally did the right thing for a change. He finally allowed the Ukraine funding to get voted on. But now he's beholden to Democrats, you know, to in order to get the funding package across the finish line. Marjorie, or as I call her, Moscow Marjorie, was threatening to unseat him, to vacate his speakership. Is that threat over? What's next in this game of cat and mouse between those two?
Well, I think the threat is over because she can't get enough members that would vote for that. She could file it. She could get it. It's already been seconded, but she won't execute. And her whole complaint is that they violated the Hastert rule, right? Which is that conservative legislation must only pass with conservatives. It cannot have any Democrats unless they are conservatives who want to ride on. It cannot pass with Democratic help. And the purpose of that was to make it so that it was always pure, you know, pure radioactive hatred for Democrats, right? Because any help from the Democrats means you're a traitor to the
Rhino
Party. So I think her shot is spent because the people that actually convinced Mike Johnson was not the director of the CIA. It was the fact that the overwhelming majority of that $60 billion was going straight into defense industries. And here's where the Patriot missile, right, which is fired and shoots down air defense and knocks down Russian hypersonic ballistic missiles and the missiles that were fired at Israel. $38 billion, I believe, for Israel, $60 billion for Ukraine. They're made in Arizona. Now, it's not like that state's not important in the election.
It's really very important.
That is straight hot cash infusion into the state of Arizona, into the top defense manufacturer there. Mm-hmm. Artillery shells. Oh, by the way, those Patriot missiles, which we have in stock that are going to the Ukrainians, are the ones that are not new. They're the old ones. Now, granted, we're defeating Russia's most advanced technology with missiles that are 10 or 15 years old.
Right. Wow. That's amazing.
In a container. And unless you shoot them, they're not going to degrade. You can check on them. You can do all sorts of stuff. They're going to stay relatively safe. It's like a bullet. Mm-hmm. But you're eventually going to have to destroy them once new stock comes in. And what happens is that Defense Department has to hire contractors to disassemble them and then blow up the warheads or disassemble the warheads. And that could cost you $1 billion to replace all these old artillery shells from Vietnam, Gulf War era artillery shells. Whereas you just put them on a pallet, put them on a ship, send them to Ukraine. They're going to be shot within a week and no expense to us except for shipping. But those new Patriot PAC-3 improved missiles, which are state of the art, are going to the U.S. Army in exchange for the older missiles, which are still kicking Russia's ass.
See, what you just explained, Malcolm, is perfect in terms of countering the argument, oh, why are we sending all this money over to Ukraine when we should be spending it here? But how you just explained it, it's like we're spending the money to basically upgrade our own shit, we're sending Ukraine our hand-me-downs.
The White House, the president said this yesterday. What you've just spent that money on is a full-scale upgrade of the U.S. Armed Forces. Every artillery shell that goes to Ukraine, here's where they're made or they've been made or stored. Pennsylvania, Ohio, Arkansas, and Alabama. That's where that hard rolled steel that's an artillery shell is made, spray painted, labeled, and tagged. Mm. We've learned something from Ukraine. Artillery is back at being the queen of the battlefield, as they call it, right? Mm-hmm. I've been bombarded silly, okay? The Russians had a 10-to-1 advantage when we did our counteroffensive. And now the Ukrainians are scrounging for shells. The Czechs actually found $1 billion worth of artillery shells from all around the world. But this war consumes them. you know, 1,000 per day or more. Wow. And you've got to, look, it's an 1,100 kilometer long battlefield. And you got to be having that stuff hit the Russians all day, all night, or they'll move forward. And the Russians, the same thing. But what's happening is we have learned you don't want just rolled steel, solid steel artillery shells. You want precision shells now. So for every one of those Vietnam era, Gulf War era shells that is just solid steel that have been sitting around, you know, for in warehouses and depots for 30 years, you're going to get a new precision munition artillery shell to replace it. So that when the Russians come, it's one artillery shell. You don't use 15 artillery shells to suppress and kill one tank and kill a few soldiers. It'll be one shell, one tank. And it will arrive 1 meter away from you or on top of you, and it will kill you. And so we're upgrading ourselves with the lessons learned from Ukraine. Yes. Also, Ukrainians also need artillery gun barrels. Because after you shoot 5 or 10,000 rounds, you got to take those barrels out and replace them. That's more valuable than shells. Those barrels are made in just three places in the United States. And guess what? We're giving them our warehoused barrels. We're upgrading the entire new U.S. Army artillery system. Because guess what? We determined that it's better to be on wheels where you can pop off three rounds, shift your position 2 or 3 miles, pop off three more rounds, because the Ukrainians have proved to us you do not sit in one spot. If you're going to fight a big war with China or Russia, they're going to get you. And the Russians are learning it because they don't move. So they get their asses kicked.
You've never, has Fox News ever approached you to be on their channel?
To be their bugaboo? To be their... You know, the problem is I cannot be on Fox News because I would start off all my segments with, what the F is wrong with you guys? Right? Bunch of idiots. But they would bring me on just to attack me, believe me.
I honestly wish you could be like the czar of explaining military equipment common sense to people, because you explained it perfectly just now.
I was explainer in chief at MSNBC, which is why I did a lot of various things. And, you know, even though I was an intelligence guy, hey, now you got an intelligence guy that's had 5,000-6,000 rounds of artillery, has been on the receiving end. We had a 3-day stretch where we had nonstop artillery. Mm. Just, it got so bad, we started doing this thing we called the A game. You would count the number of shells, then you'd sing a song, and then you're just like punch drunk. You know, it's like 47, 48, la di da di da di da, 49, 51, da di da di da. That's how much stuff is coming. And as I explain to people, this is not the Gulf War where we had total dominance. This is not Desert Storm, which I took part in, and Iraq, which I took part in, or Afghanistan. This is the Ardennes Forest, 1944, when the fog is in the Battle of the Bulge, where it's tank, man, artillery, mortar. That's it. No air power. And drones are those little low-flying Piper Cub airplanes to do observation with some direct attack. But there's no air power. There's no air-to-air battles or like World War II. And there is no air dominance by either side. And Russia can't fly their planes there. They fly some. But, it's another school I went to, Stinger Anti-Aircraft Missile School. And it's just like, they've learned that missile cannot be defeated. It will kill you. So that's why I explain things so good when you've got a lot of experience.
Well, I'm glad you made it back safely here. I want to switch gears onto a topic that's related, but not as closely related. Since Mike Johnson escaped his little danger with Marjorie Taylor Greene, he is recently zipped off to New York City to Columbia University to dip his toe into the Israel-Gaza protest there to denounce the president of Columbia and pressure her to step down. What exactly is happening there? Can you unpack that for my listeners?
Yeah, and this is where you're going to start getting your hate mail. first off, let me, full disclosure, as we like to say in the news media, I spent my first 17 years working Middle East counterterrorism starting in Lebanon, working against what would become Hezbollah, the Shia Amal militias, the Palestinian diaspora, Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, Al-Fatah in Lebanon, all these things, right? I speak Levantine dialect Arabic. That's the first dialect I ever learned, which is Syrian, Lebanese, Palestinian dialect. I've been to the West Bank. I've spent time in Israel. I just came back from, you know, five, almost 6 weeks in Israel, you know, been around. And that's my first few years there. I spent the better part on and off working missions to find 125 Western hostages in Lebanon. And it took a long time. So I know a little something about the Middle East. I spent the better part of 40 years there, lived in the Middle East most of my career, lived there, and just spent 10 years in the Gulf states. I was in Abu Dhabi for 10 years. That being said, I spent my entire career defending Muslims from bad Muslims, right? From terrorists. Working with them, right? I helped liberate Kuwait City from Saddam Hussein. You know, I helped against Al-Qaeda, who was trying to seize control of Islam through Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, right? And believe me, the biggest issue I had when I lived in Abu Dhabi and I was working with the Emiratis is they did not like Palestinians. And they thought between the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood backed groups like Palestinian Islamic Jihad, they did not want that infection in their countries. They didn't. They thought Al-Qaeda could be managed, right? ISIS can be managed. You just kill them and they're gone. Whereas the overwhelming majority of teachers in, for example, in Dubai, in the Arab schools were Palestinian. And so during the first Gulf War, before the first Gulf War, the Kuwaitis had a little problem. When Saddam invaded Kuwait, the Palestinians in Kuwait, over 100,000 of them, had been secretly working with Saddam and helped them seize the country. At the end of Desert Storm, where I was there, and I saw the effects of this, the Kuwaitis deported every Palestinian in that country. Because they could, you know, it wasn't because they couldn't trust them. It's just that that diaspora sided with their immediate enemy. And so Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, all maybe except Oman. I've never seen a Palestinian in Oman. I'm sure there's a few, but or Yemen, right? They got their own issues. Those diaspora, which are, I'm sorry, I'm going to tell you some things. The Palestinians are the most intelligent and most well-educated of all the people in the Muslim world, with maybe save except Iran, but they're not Arabs, right? They're Persians. Very well-educated. I think they have some crazy number, like 90% educated. When I say educated, I mean bachelor's degree.
Wow.
Yeah, they're smart. They could, had they decided to do it, could have turned Gaza into Singapore. And they would be blitzing Israeli companies. They would have the Turks would have come in there and thrown boatloads of money in the Qataris. The problem is that this issue, which is not, by the way, 75 years old. I have people come to me all the time and they go, oh, you hate Arabs. It's like, no.
Can I wait. I listened to your show the other night, the Black Man Spy. I want to say it's 3,000 years, you said, correct?
3,000 years. You know, the funny thing is that when you go to Israel, and I have people who are here, young Black kids, white kids, even Arab Americans who go, Jews all came from Europe. Well, you got to go to Israel to see. Israel is a very brown country, very brown. 80% of the population are Arab Jews. They're Mizrahi, which
in
means
Israel.
Yes, I interviewed a woman who was born in Baghdad, 1947, and they seized everything. One day they were there, the next day they were on a bus to Damascus and trying to make their way to Israel. The government at the time seized every asset they had. there was a massive ethnic cleansing of Jews from all across the Muslim world. Historic fact documented. But one thing I learned in Israel is when you go around, you look at the archaeology, Hebrew has been extant in its form that it is today for almost 3,000 years. Jews can read ancient manuscripts because it's the same language. You know, for people to say this is 75 years. No, it's not. They speak the same language. They practice the exact same religion. They are living on the exact same land at the same time. Same with the Christians. Christians have been there since the time of Jesus Christ, who was a Jewish rabbi. Okay? Christianity didn't really form until after his death, which was the philosophy of Jesus Christ. And the reason I mention this in the Torah, which is the Old Testament, and Jesus' scripture, which is the New Testament, are all integral components of a book called the Quran, right? And in the Quran, Jesus is the most powerful of all prophets. He isn't God. He is the most powerful of all prophets and will help the Messiah, right? The Messiah return on Judgment Day. And he will return to, you know, establish God's earthly caliphate. How do you not know? And I get people who get in my face and go, oh, you hate Islam. You hate Muslims. Like, no, I know a little something about this. Because the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, lived in a city, not a city, a very small village that was an economic center called Mecca. And one of the two indigenous families in Mecca was a Jewish family. Because in 610, Judaism had already existed for 2,600 years. Right? Christianity was only 600 years old. Mm-hmm. And when the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, this created Islam to become the seal of the prophets, he was in a city with Jews and Christians. And the Prophet went and met the Ethiopian Coptic Christians, which sealed them within Islam as a protected religion. Same with Judaism. He went himself up the trading trails up to Aqaba and Madaba and Petra to Jerusalem, which you can walk that trip, okay, on the camel trip, which is why he knew Jerusalem so well, why Dome of the Rock is there, why he had his night dream and traveled to God. You know, it's a long, I've gone out in the desert. There's a lot to talk about when you're doing it on a camel. I've ridden a camel in the desert. All you're going to do is talk like we're talking right now. Why I'm getting into this little history lesson is, the Palestinian-Israeli crisis right now is focused on one thing in my world. I come from counterterrorism. Mm-hmm. On 6 October, there was no fighting between Hamas and the Israelis.
Right.
The morning of 7 October, executing a two-year-long plan, Hamas stormed across that fence. And I have been there. I have seen it. And they killed every man, woman, child, and very interestingly, every dog, every family dog that was over there. They killed Christians. They killed Muslims. They killed Druze. They killed Coptics. They killed Hindus. They killed Filipina Catholics. They killed a boatload of Buddhist rice workers from Thailand. And most interestingly, they slaughtered a family of 70 Bedouins that had been there for centuries. Slaughtered them. And you know what they said to them when the Bedouins told them? They said, you're no better than Jewish dogs because you're on this side of the fence. They killed all the Palestinian Muslims, or Arab Israelis, they call them. An Arab Israeli is a Palestinian that stayed in 1948 in Israel. The people that left in 1948 because the Arab armies told them to leave, the Palestinian diaspora that we see today. So you cannot bring this story back to 75 years. The story is now about, and these students are now advocating not for, and this is my problem with it. I have saved a lot of Muslims in my career. I've fired the machine gun at many of my guys' weddings, okay? I love my guys getting married and, you know, having kids and saying, Chief, I named my baby Malcolm or Malik after you, right? Because Malcolm means Malakum, right? Nothing for you. Malik means king. So
interesting. Yeah.
But these people now started out initially on the afternoon of 10/7, celebrating the slaughter of 1,200 people in a massive terrorist attack. My terrorism wall will not allow me to authorize that as being a good thing. That's like celebrating 9/11.
Right.
Then it went when the Israelis did what the Israelis do. Israel is an overwhelming military power, overwhelming. There are people today that come up and say, Palestine is almost free, the Israelis are defeated. And it's like, you live in an alternate reality. Either Gaza is being leveled or you're winning and you're about to get all of Israel. Which one is it? You can't do both. When the Israelis came and carried out their military war plan, and it was a war, okay? Mm-hmm. This is war. This isn't counterterrorism. It's not counterinsurgency. Straight up in your face warfare. And the reason it's so brutal in Gaza is Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad put a 30,000-man combat force underground in the middle of a urban area that is like, I want you to think of the entirety of fully inhabited Brooklyn, and then fight every 100 meters through every building in it with a combat force that's throwing ammunition your way, and you're using air power. You are going to devastate that place. Every war is like this. These people now have shifted from, in my opinion, supporting the people of Gaza and the humanitarian needs that they have, right? Food's getting in, 350 trucks a day. The humanitarian corridors are open. The Egyptians are bringing them in. But it's not the 500 a day they were getting before, but that 500 a day was bringing in like 100 of concrete and pipes that were being used to make rockets. Food is getting in. It's there. There is no starvation going on. They're selling US MREs for $3 in the souk there. How do I know? They show it on YouTube, right? And they won't eat them. They're halal.
What's an MRE?
Oh, meals ready to eat that we're dropping from the airplanes. They're halal. We're funding them through Jordan. The Jordanians are dropping them. They got Pop-Tarts. Halal Pop-Tarts. Mm-hmm. So the point here is that what started as the support for the Palestinian people has over this last 6 months transformed into the elimination of Israel movement. And so when people say to me, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, that means, and first off, a lot of kids don't know which river or what sea. Okay. Mm. I'll tell your audience, the Jordan River, which I have been to and crossed over, right, on the Allenby Bridge, and I've been to the Dead Sea on both sides, and the Mediterranean Sea, which I spent years steaming into, right? I was just there, where they got great surf schools and tacos in Tel Aviv. This is the, how can I put it? This is what these young students are chanting for, is the destruction of the state of Israel. It is mindless. It sounds fun when you're saying it, but it's almost the equivalent of Al-Qaeda will defeat you being on campus after 9/11. Because what you're asking for is not just the deaths of 6 million Jews, only 15% of the, you know, of whom, you know, Jews represent a very small minority in this world. You're also calling for the death of the 2 million Arab Israelis, the Palestinians who have been living there since 1948. Also, the 100,000 Ethiopians. Also, again, the 80% of Jews are brown. They're from Arab countries. I had a hard time finding white people there. Really.
Let me stop you for a minute.
All right.
So, as I understand our universities, and I'm not even talking about Ivy League like Columbia. I'm saying in general, college. Right. College is. It's our place of higher learning. When you're talking about a university like Columbia, that's the upper echelon. That's where we send That's where you send your kids when you really want them to learn something bigger and better and higher.
Or Harvard. Now,
what's that?
Or Harvard.
Or Harvard or Yale, Princeton. Those
they're all kinds having projects. You know, funny thing is, I haven't heard anything about Princeton.
So here's what I'm getting at, right? I'm not that smart as far as the Middle East is concerned and all of its intricacies. However, I have heard the phrase from the river to the sea, you know, and I've also heard that it implies a genocide of the Israeli people. So sure. Naturally, I don't care how, you know, cool anybody thinks it sounds. The fact that Israelis or Jewish people feel threatened by that, I would not use that. Now, we know that kids in colleges tend to be more sensitive, right, about things that are offensive to people. You know, they call universities basically like wokeism centers, right? So why would they be employing this language? And that's question number one. And question number two, are these protests being infiltrated by weaponized people who are intending to steer a narrative in a direction that potentially harms left-wing progressives?
Okay, you can just stop using the word progressive for the extreme left wing that are part of the Free Palestine movement. I'm now speaking as a professional. Just remove that phrase. All right. There are people who are there who are extremists for any cause that comes up. And people were referring to them as Antifa and all that stuff. Do you remember in the Portland riots, there were groups called the Black Bloc? The Black Bloc were those extremist guys who wear the black mask and the Black Lives
Matter. I've seen them.
Yeah. Break up the sidewalks. They're hardcore chaos agents. Left wing, right? You know, mainly coming from the Democratic Socialists of America and some of these more extremist links. They, along with well-meaning people who after, you know, the day of 10-7 and day of 10-8, the people who were celebrating were, I'm sorry to say, part of the Palestinian diaspora in the world, and including the United States, who saw the attack on Israel as an achievement for their people. Even as we were going on air, I was on air. I was in Dubai the next day, right? And doing news programs, you know, BBC, London Broadcasting, and going, whoa, this is a mass murder, right? Do you know what's coming? You kill 1,200 Jews, you're going to get the full might of the Israeli armed forces. And let me be honest with you, they have certainly not even seen a fraction of what the Israelis can do.
Malcolm, here's my point. Here's my point.
I just want to make one last point on this.
Yeah.
Israel, by the way, is a nuclear power, so I don't know if people understand that.
Oh, yeah.
The people who have started were the diaspora. Then came the allies. Then came the agitators. And I think that by December, you start seeing a transition, definitely by January, away from the lives of Palestinian children to, from the river to the sea, you know, resistance. When they had the big march down here on Fifth Avenue, resistance by all means necessary. That's an open call for terrorism. All right, all means necessary is what happened on October 7th, the slaughter of every man, woman, child, and dog in southern Israel, no matter what their religious faith or confession was. I think that this is going in a bad way, and here's why. One, the people at Columbia, which is right up the road here, yesterday were saying that outsiders were coming in there. There are members who are known to be affiliated with Hamas. Some of these people live in New York City. New York's a huge city, so they have a big Arab Muslim diaspora. Mm-hmm. And they are supporting these movements. But the schools have been so slow to secure the campus, all right, which is the gates, not let anybody in that doesn't have an ID card, that they've just been overwhelmed. Also, there was organization for every school in America to have this protest yesterday and to start occupying the campuses. Here's where this is going to get bad. Again, 40 years in terrorism, right?
Mm-hmm.
Someone is going to take this to the next level. And there will be an act of political violence in the name of the Palestinian people or Hamas or whatever. And you're going to see this whole movement disappear overnight. It'll be like, again, until there is a direct impact on the American people, there's a lot of tolerance for what's going on. But, you know, when you block the highway to JFK, you know, people are going to get a little angry. But if you carry out a terrorist attack, which is all I'm concerned about with the health, safety of everybody, you kill a Jewish student because he's a Jew, you attack someone or you blow up a pipe bomb or set off a firecracker that's too big, the entire Joint Terrorism Task Force system of the United States is going to set up, take notice, and that movement is going to be horribly damaged.
Here's my point, Malcolm, right? Let's go back 4 years, the summer of 2020. And I'm talking about the what's the name of the guy with
George Floyd?
Thank you. We had the we had the George Floyd protests, right? And George I'm specifically summer. Using the word protest because by and large, the vast majority of those protests were peaceful. There were people kneeling and praying and playing music, and you know they were peaceful. However, we had some pockets of extreme violence where we had people, and I would like to I'm saying that these were people from probably those groups that you mentioned,
the black
wearing the black garb. And the fact that their faces are concealed, they're wearing masks, you can't really even confirm who they represent, right?
Now,
who benefits from a peaceful movement being hijacked and distorted and perverted into something gross and violent and deadly, even destructive and deadly? Who benefits from that? It worked to discredit the Black Lives Matter movement.
Let me tell you. I know exactly where you're going. I will tell you who's not going to do this. All right. You're not going to find any Jewish master hands coming from the Rothschilds doing this. The group we talked about, Black Bloc, has swapped out their white people, overwhelmingly white, have swapped out their black mask and black suits and their bags with monkey wrenches and sledgehammers pulling up bricks to wearing kufiyas around their face now. I'm surprised at how overwhelmingly, that the supporters and allies of this who are actual organizers on the ground are these same people who were involved in not the African-American community that was protesting George Floyd, but the so-called allies who came there and helped start the riots. We know, yes, there were white, right-wing extremists who went around, were smashing windows, and were pretending to be left-wing extremists. But I'm talking about the people in that famous video in Santa Monica, where three women, all wearing black, one Asian, two white, were spray-painting Black Power on a Starbucks. And a black woman confronts them and goes, "You don't speak for us. Why are you doing that?" And she goes, "We're allies." Well, guess where they are now? They're
in prison,
jacking or facilitating the edges of the Free Palestine movement. The only problem is the Free Palestine movement likes their energy, likes their enthusiasm, likes their ability to get into the street with them and validate them. And I think that this is not necessarily a great thing. Muslims should not be attacking Jews on the street. Should not have to feel uncomfortable anywhere. The same way after 9/11, Muslims were defended. I defended them. My whole life I've defended them. Mm-hmm. Any Islamophobia, I'll be the first one to smack it down. Vice versa. Same thing for blacks, same thing for Muslims, same thing for Hindus. I don't care who you are. I fought my entire life to defend your right to say any stupid thing you want, including free Palestine or Hamas is great or whatever. Now, that being said, I mm-hmm. am the explainer in chief here. If someone goes beyond what they're doing, I want to point something out to you. I've noticed that the movement has glommed onto the words of Malcolm X.
But any means necessary.
By any means necessary. They use that all the time. I see signs all the time. Resistance, you know, resistance is a priority or whatever it is. But they don't use the words of Martin Luther King. Right?
Right.
That they would use a peaceful means. I mean, you want to be a powerful? Here's powerful. Get into the middle of Fifth Avenue, sit down, don't say a word. Don't say a word. Mm-hmm. Let your movement speak for you, right? Nope. Getting in JFK and shutting down the Van Wyck, right? And I put a tweet out for this, and you're going to get you're going to get a lot of hate mail over this, where I said, your movement is hated by Americans, hated. We just haven't gotten to the point where your right to free speech has become a wave of rancor to where now law enforcement is going to enforce the law.
But Malcolm, where is the space for people to stand up and object to Netanyahu's blatant targeting of civilian populations in the Palestinian areas in Gaza? Where's the space for that? For people objecting to the killing of 10,000 children. Where is that space?
First off, I don't want to have the numbers debate because I want to point out
because it can't be confirmed.
No, because in 2014 or 2015, the first Hamas-Israel war occurred, and at the end of 52 days, Hamas claimed 25,000 civilians were killed. When it was all over and done with, they sat down and they counted them all. 80% or 75% of the people killed were men and combatants. And it was regrettable. 500, 400 some odd children were killed. Some 400, 500 women were killed. But the numbers were completely off by an order of magnitude. I've had this discussion on television debates. If you're going to show me 30,000 killed, and that's a number, by the way, which comes from a terrorist group. It does not come from the health ministry of Gaza. There is none. There is the Hamas health ministry, and it's been proven mathematically all they did was multiply the number every day. But civilians are dying. Civilians are dying.
Why can't we get an accurate count?
You won't get an accurate count till this thing's over and done with. Civilians are dying because the entire Hamas infrastructure was built to kill civilians. I wrote a Substack about this called Hamas Needs Dead Babies for both sides. Mm-hmm. And that they put their infrastructure next to schools, next to mosques, into hospitals because they knew. Don't believe me, Malcolm. What would you know about it? I'm going to quote Ismail Haniyeh. And he said, we need the blood of our dead citizens in order to stoke the revolutionary fervor, right, of our fighters to fight the Israelis.
But isn't there a way to get at Hamas without, like use a scalpel instead of a sledgehammer? Isn't there a way to do that?
Okay. No. Okay. No. There's no way. We did this in Fallujah. In the second battle of Fallujah in 2004, we removed 90% of the population of the city of Fallujah. And I've been in Fallujah. That is a very low, it's not a city, it's a town that's very low. Four stories is the top. Gaza is 25 miles separated only by one little area called Wadi Gaza. 25 miles by 6 miles of 5 to 10 story concrete block buildings, except for the Shatit, right? The coast.
Mm-hmm.
And the green belt that goes along the Israeli border. It is a dense urban area. It is Stalingrad in 1944. Hamas chose that battleground. They did what they did to bring the Israelis in, and they knew there would be grievous casualties. The problem is the Israelis went at it with, well, two ways. One, what we call a 100-meter war, 100 yards. That's a football field, right? That's how far the average gun battle takes place. Mm. And the Israeli army had to eat through northern Gaza 100 meters at a time. Now, when the Israelis are moving forward 100 meters, it's not, okay, I walk 100 meters and I take that place. It's 100 meters of contested battlefield where you're being shot at with machine gun bullets and RPGs and rockets and mortars. So the Israelis are shooting back. So what's happening is 100 meters of destruction at a time until you eat all the way up from Kfar unit, you know, from the north, right? All the way down to the south, right? And that 5-10 miles is destroyed. Hamas would not let the civilians leave that area. The Israeli airstrikes there were not indiscriminate, even though people have used that word a lot. Israel knows what they're aiming at. Indiscriminate is like just flying over it, not even looking and just letting them all go. It's discriminate. The problem is civilians and their infrastructure were what we call bomb sponges for the Hamas tunnel system, that those buildings would absorb the impacts before they would get to the tunnels. Hamas's strategy was to use the civilians, not as human shield, but as human sponges for Israeli bombs.
Why
came in on ground, that's where Hamas lost, because you can't beat the Israelis on the ground. You can't.
So why did Netanyahu help to prop up Hamas over the Palestinian Authority?
And here's where you're going to get an answer that will quite surprise you. You ask, where's the anti-Netanyahu space that people can go to and say, you know, where you, my Twitter timeline? Not a fan. I hope to interview him. You know, John Spencer interviewed him. I can interview him. And it's going to be, really? You thought you could buy a terrorist group? Because here's what Netanyahu did. In 2005, he so hated Yasser Arafat and Fatah, his military wing, which became the Palestinian Authority under the Oslo Accords. Mm-hmm. Not Netanyahu himself, but, you know, at the time it was Rabin, who ate a bullet for getting out of Gaza, for pulling Jews out of Gaza and desettling Gaza. Rabin was murdered by his own people, to give you an idea of how hot that place is. When Netanyahu came into power, he thought, I hate Arafat, so let's kill Arafat. Let's defang the Palestinian Authority. And that somehow, by backing Hamas, that they would wipe out Fatah for them in Gaza, which is what happened. They literally slaughtered, like, I think it's almost 1,000 members of the Fatah police and military forces and political body. When Hamas took power, they summarily executed them all. There's a great book called Hamas versus Fatah, which spells out the slaughter. And Netanyahu let a terrorist group come in, but thought that money and power would temper them. He allowed Qatar to give them money, thinking Gulf state money and power would temper them. He apparently never read Hamas's charter, which is the utter slaughter of all Jews. They are Al-Qaeda and ISIS wrapped in a Palestinian national flag. And I have these terrorism experts, you know, I've written several books on ISIS and Al-Qaeda, including a Times bestseller. And I have these guys going, they're not ISIS. No, they're not Salafist jihadists who are trying to call for an Islamic caliphate to take over the world right now. They are not Fatah. When I was a baby spy back in the 80s, Fatah was a socialist movement sponsored by the Soviet Union and other states. And they had women without, you know, with their hair exposed and running around with guns.
Yeah.
Now, what that was, Palestinian nationalism. That's what Arafat was. That's what all that terrorism was Palestinian nationalism. This is Islamic fundamentalism wrapped in the philosophy of the Muslim Brotherhood, which has a Palestinian flag wrapped around the philosophy of the utter destruction of all Jews. So it's sort of a hybrid Al-Qaeda, ISIS, you know, philosophy. But they're not very good at it. Yes, they did invade Israel. Yes, Israel was too arrogant and didn't see it. Yes, Netanyahu should resign from his job for failing at the one mission that he had, which was the protection of the Israeli people. There are protests in Israel every day. You want to go to the art museum where the families of the hostages are. You want to see some things, man. Those people go over to Ministry of Defense and they get in the street and they throw down. And Netanyahu sends cops after him. Guy is, he's popular only for one thing, is that he is the current leader of a coalition government. But he politically, no one is supporting him to stay the prime minister. There is no secret plan to get every person out of Gaza. Impossible, right? Now, if Donald Trump were president, he would be pushing that plan. Ship them all off to Egypt, let them all walk to the West Bank, right? Take it over and Jared Kushner will build resorts there. Because it's really nice, by the way, really nice beaches. That's what they would do. But that's not what's at play here. The average Israeli does not want that. The average Israeli just wants to be left alone and in peace. It's as simple as that. But when you pop 10,000 rockets into central Israel and every major city in Israel, you are going to get what the Israelis are good at, which is they have prepared since 1948 to have overwhelming firepower to defeat any enemies. They have they defeated the Egyptians, the Syrians, the Jordanians, and the Saudis, and everybody else simultaneously with one of the smaller armies in the Middle East. So there is no military solution to this for whoever wants to see a free Palestine. They are going to have to defang their terrorism, stop the suicide bombing, stop the rockets, sit down and deal with Israel as an entity that will never, ever go away. It ain't going anywhere. And that's why Israelis are working against the Iranians. The Iranians want a nuke, okay? And nuclear weapons changes the entire dynamic of this.
That's not going to end well.
Not? Are you kidding? You should just start thinking that there could be a Hiroshima or Nagasaki in our lifetime if Iran starts getting on the cusp of developing a nuclear weapon.
Which we were, I think, headed in the right direction away from that when the United States was part of that Iran deal.
Yeah, the problem with the Iranians, not the Iranians, by the way. The Iranian people are smart. They're intelligent. When I lived in Abu Dhabi, I met lots of Iranians. I know what the average Iranian wants. They want a 2024 Toyota Corolla. They want prosperity for their family, their kids. They want to be left in peace. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps and the mullahs are an entirely different animal. They, and this is something that is also controversial, they are not in a battle for control of Jerusalem. Yes, they've surrounded Israel with hostile entities on three sides, Iraqis, Syrians, Lebanese, Yemenis, and Hamas. The real battle is for the control of Islam. There is a 1,400-year-old battle between Shia Islam and Sunni. And the Saudis are terrified of the Iranians getting a nuke. Saudis will go to Pakistan. They'll offer to buy one. They'll put $100 billion on the table. It gets to that. I mean, so the inner machinations, you see how we went from children in Hamas in Gaza to Iran deciding to flex its power and throw 351 missiles, cruise missiles, and ballistic missiles at Israel. And Israel, and the only person they hurt was a seven-year-old Muslim Bedouin child who is now recovering. That's how strong Israel is.
Let me bring us back all the way back to Columbia University. How do these, because it's not just Columbia, actually. I think it's Texas, and it's, as you said, it's
all over. Like, it's all over. It's at NYU, it's at Columbia, it's over, you know, there was a big movement where they all rushed the center of Harvard Yard. You know, it's all fun and games. You know, I defend their right to say any stupid thing they want. Protest.
What's the best way to deal with these protests? Do we just let them continue? Are they going to peter out on their own?
No, the schools have already been brought, have been warned that if students, any student cannot go and study peacefully on campus, then they have an unacceptable situation. And meaning? The problem right now, these protests are disruptive. And like the person, people at Columbia said, who were part of that movement, they say it's the outside agitators from, you know, the diaspora and the black bloc guys who are ready to get throw down and fight with the NYPD. And it's going to get awful. And what's going to happen is you're going to have, and this is what I was saying earlier, an American backlash to where you will go from where the, you know, most, the majority of African-Americans will support you to where they hate you. You know, that flipped, by the way, on one day. There was a video of Palestinians that went to a black Democratic Party Christmas party and started fighting and punching these little old ladies in December. And what? Overnight, the video went what? You go.
I missed it. I totally missed it. Yeah.
The video went viral, and instantly it was like all blacks over the age of 35 were like, we don't support you. You know, you cannot make your advocacy become violent. You cannot throw it in people's faces.
Yeah.
They were pulling the Martin Luther King, Edmund Pettus Bridge thing, they'd be fine. But that's not what we're seeing. We're seeing a lot of hotheads. I lived in that world. People can get quite emotional. And then they look at guys like me and they go, you're a Zionist. You're a colonist. You're a genocide lover. And it's like, really? Really?
I understand the whole concept and premise of protest is that you do have to make heads turn. You do have to stop traffic. You do have to make people sit up and notice like some shit is going on. You're not going to draw attention to your cause by sitting at home quietly praying in your basement. You know, you do have to make people uncomfortable because otherwise, why is anyone going to pay attention to you? But you shouldn't. But you don't have the right to make people feel unsafe. You don't have the right to threaten people physically or actually take actions against them physically. You know, right. There has to be there's a fine line between I support your cause and what the fuck are you doing, you know, in my face, threatening me, punching me, you know, right?
Right. Well, you know, and there's always going to be that violent edge. And we talked about who some of those people are, and they harness the emotions of a very, you know, of people who are being very emotional about deaths that they see overseas. But, you know, we don't see Israeli, pro-Israeli marches going out and, you know, throwing punches or saying we will make Arab students on this campus feel unwelcome if they wear a kufiya around their neck, which, by the way, most of these people are wearing it wrong. Okay. I'm an old guy. I've lived in the Muslim world most of my life. If you're not some old guy wearing a suit and shuffling down the street with a gutra ekel, you know, on your kufiya, you're wearing it militant style. Then what is the purpose of that? You don't want your face to be known. You're wrapping it the way that Fatah wrapped it when they did terrorist attacks. What is your symbology? Yeah. If it was a peaceful march down Fifth Avenue, all right, not calling for the genocide of Jews, right? There was one yesterday. We don't mean some of it. We mean all of it. You're talking about Israel.
Yeah.
It's like, you don't even know what you're talking about. Here's what's never going to happen. Like this 80-year-old Iraqi Jewish woman said to me, you know, you're never getting Israel. It exists. You would have to kill 2 million Palestinians that have lived there and flourished forever, who saved lives on 10/7. The one guy I really want to meet is an Israeli Arab, a Palestinian, who is an ambulance driver who drove back and forth into the Middle East battles with a Mogan David ambulance, right? The Israeli star, and saved the lives of dozens of people.
Wow.
And his wife was like, why did you do it? And she goes, it's my job. It's my country.
Yeah.
That's what you should aspire to be, is people who live in peaceful coexistence. I love Jerusalem when I'm there, right? They wouldn't let me to the Dome of the Rock this time, because you have to prove to them you're a Muslim, right? You have to prove you're a good Muslim. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and you'll see it in one of my previous, in one of my next Black Man Spy episodes. I have a Jerusalem episode where the city is divided into the four sectors, right? The Muslim sector, the Jewish sector, quarter, they call them, the Armenian quarter, the Christian quarter. But to walk in the path of Jesus Christ, you have to enter through the Lion Gate, which is in the Muslim sector, Muslim quarter. And to get to the first five of the 13, however many stations of the cross, where Jesus literally walked with a 300-pound cross on his back, right? Damn. Which, by the way, is honored in Islam as part of the Quran. Mm-hmm. You've got to go through all three sectors of that, of that city. And you can literally walk where the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, walked. You can literally walk where Jesus Christ walked and preached. You can walk where every Talmudic scholar since King Solomon has been. And I got kids here in the United States talking about, well, this is 75 years and you don't know anything about it. Well, in fact, 40 of that 75 years, I've been involved with this in keeping the peace. Not a colonist. Oh, by the way, you know who the colonists were? The Greeks. When they invaded, or the Phoenicians, or the Romans. These are the colonists. People don't understand. Judea and Samaria existed when the Romans created, well, took it over and made a Roman province out of it in 79 AD. And then wiped out the Jewish resistance, which was sort of like, you know, Hamas in 76 BC to 79 AD when the first Judean war started. 35 years or 30 some odd years after Jesus Christ's death. That's when the Romans changed the name to Philistina. And I explain that. I explain how the Romans stole Greek mythology and Jaffa, and the place is old, right? There's a monument to King Ramesses II from the Jews who escaped under Moses.
I'm going to have to rewatch that episode of Black Man Spy, and I highly recommend. Highly advise my listeners here, check it out, because it's eye opening. The stuff that I learned just watching one episode of Black Man Spy. I have to rewatch that episode and then watch the other one, and watch all of the ones that you have coming out soon. Before we bounce, I did want to ask you about the whole TikTok thing, because that's another area that you kind of specialize in. So the president recently signed a bill that says that TikTok has to divest, I guess, from China in order to continue operating in the United States. I don't see what the big deal is. I don't have any, national security secrets on my phone and my TikTok. It's collecting cobwebs anyway. What's the big threat? Why is everybody worried about China and TikTok?
There's a new study. I want to say it's by Rand. It came out 2 days ago. And it's about the influence of TikTok. Go on Twitter and just put in TikTok study. Mm-hmm. They show that someone who registers as an American 13-year-old boy, all right? That's how they did this controlled experiment. And they mapped everywhere the TikTok algorithm brought this person, this imaginary person. Mm-hmm. It started off with really benign, you know, dog, puppy TikToks and, you know, funny stories. Right. And by the time it speciates, right, it grows, the algorithm figures out who this person is, not what he likes, but what it's going to send to him. And if you look at this chart, there's this little blue blurb there of all these little boxes of the nice sites that it sent them. And then 85% of that chart, it takes them to war videos, anti-government videos, this is interesting.
Holy shit.
Pro-Israel videos, naturally, that you would stumble across are less than 12%, but it's like 86% pro-Palestine, anti-Israeli things. The algorithm was built with the purpose of collecting one gabillions of bytes of data of personal, profiles of Westerners. Two, it feeds in there what the government of China and its intelligence agencies want to do to undermine democracy. And it's just crazy. Oh, just pushes Trump left and right, woo, you know, like an elephant. But here's the best part. Here's a little thought experiment for you. One day I woke up, I have two TikTok videos up on my TikTok feed. And one of them is me going that 57% of kids under the age of 34 said that 10/7 was justified by Hamas. And I was like, whoa. And I did a TikTok going, this is like you supporting Al-Qaeda after 9/11.
Yeah.
Then this thing popped up on TikTok called Letters to America. And this good-looking African-American caller
makeup. Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen this, but they've been keeping this from us. And, you know, I didn't know this was, she says, it's created an existential crisis in me about where I am and where I am in life. And it watches it. And it's all about Osama bin Laden's letter to America justifying the mass murder of 3,000 Americans on 9/11. Yeah. And within days, there were thousands of these videos of people extolling the virtues of Al-Qaeda in support of free Palestine and saying America deserved what it got on 9/11. I did a TikTok video that started like this. Are you out of your minds? Right? After it really went viral and got mentioned in Congress, the Chinese pulled it all down. And one day, every video disappeared because they said, we do not support terrorism, blah, blah, blah.
Wow.
The point is, they infected us. It is a virus deployment system, almost as bad as the Wuhan virus, as COVID. But the purpose of it is to hack your mind with whatever the Central Communist Party of China wants. It's a weapon system.
So will the sale of TikTok, to, let's say, an American investor or American billionaire or whatever, will the sale of that company end the threat? Or does TikTok have to be completely ripped down and decoded or whatever?
Well, China has already said they will not let us know what the algorithm is. Now, you can identify the algorithm. What really needs to happen is good old capitalism, right? Which is the Chinese are now capitalists, which is create an alternate to TikTok, but make sure it has moderation in it. Right? Controls. You know, we have laws on what can be said on television and in newspapers, right?
Right.
Well, we can throw in some strict controls about your algorithm cannot force someone to hunt for or to see things which they did not themselves hunt for. Right. Right? Like sending you, look at Elon Musk had Dom Luker, some crazy guy, black guy on Twitter, who posted child pornography. But because he's a friend of Elon Musk, all they did was took it down and didn't ban him. Right? Twitter's just as bad. Twitter's a right-wing extremist weapon system that's working against democracy. Mm-hmm. But we're used to letting free speech fly, right? Our freak flag fly for free speech. But TikTok is an order. I've seen it now in action. And it is people justifying 9/11. Tens of thousands of American kids going, well, you lied to us. Bin Laden was right. Bin Laden was right. All right? That's a weapon. It's a propaganda cruise missile into the mind of every one of our children. And we need to moderate what our children watch anyway. We're awful at that.
Malcolm Nance, I don't think I know I don't think I know anybody as learned, as smart in so many different areas as you. I can't. Mistel. What's that?
No, Michael Harriet and Elie Mistel. Those are two smart brothers.
I know, but I don't know them. I know you.
Michael Harriet, amazing.
But thank you so much for sharing your knowledge with me and with my listeners. I want to strongly recommend you check out Black Man Spy. It's on YouTube. You can just type in Malcolm Nance or Black Man Spy. Sir, where else can people find your knowledge and your.
Yeah. Since I'm not on MSNBC much anymore, my big works, my real analysis is being done on malcolmnance.substack.com. That's where I put out my long form things. Most of the articles are free, and there's some very detailed analysis. You can go back, a year and a half and see how, unfortunately, I'm right a lot.
You are.
I don't know why, but it's the world is an easy place to interpret, and I'm rarely wrong, and that's what's horrible about my line of business in counterterrorism. But you are going to get some flack for having me on board, but I defend your right to disagree with me, and so long as it's done in the spirit of debate.
I thought it was a great conversation, and I look forward to another one if you'll join me on the show again.
Sure.
Thank you again, Malcolm.
All right, take care.
That's all the time we have today for Malcolm Nance. I want to leave you with something before we go. In the spirited debates across college campuses like Columbia, USC, University of Texas, and Cal Berkeley, students champion the plight of Palestinians with a passion that speaks to their deep commitment to global justice. While their advocacy underscores a commendable empathy for the suffering of others, there is an underlying concern about the influences shaping these movements. It's crucial to scrutinize the motives of organizations behind the scenes, ensuring these student movements remain grounded in safety and constructive dialogue rather than veering into potentially divisive territories where we're calling for the elimination of the Jewish state or giving support to Hamas. There is no romance in terrorism. Hamas is not SDS. This is not 1968. These students are in the midst of a highly nuanced and delicate global issue that has raged for decades. While it's okay to feel angry about the indiscriminate bombing of babies and the killing of tens of thousands of civilians, we must not call for the spilling of Jewish blood in return. The world has seen far too much of that already on both sides. Let us ask for peace, for a ceasefire, and for the establishment of Palestinian statehood as part of a two-state solution. Thanks for listening. Stay defiant.